Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 63 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I got to speak with Dr. Barry Strauss, a professor of classics and a military and naval historian at Cornell University. As the series editor of Princeton's Turning Points in Ancient History and author of 9 books on ancient history, Professor Strauss is a recognized authority on the subject of leadership and the lessons that can be learned from the experiences of the greatest political and military leaders of the ancient world, like Caesar, Hannibal, Alexander, and others. He is a former director of Cornell's Judith Reppe Institute for Peace and Conflict Studies, where he studied modern engagements from Bosnia to Iraq and from Afghanistan to Europe. He has also made numerous television appearances on the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, CNN, PBS, and Netflix, and also hosts the popular podcast Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World. In this episode, I was excited to discuss why Julius Caesar is his favorite ancient military leader, what it means to be a global citizen by comparing differences between EU-US systems, and look at accuracy or inaccuracy of adaptations of ancient battles in film and TV. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy. Thank you so much for joining me on today's podcast. I was really excited for this conversation. So I want to start us off with what I hope will be just a very easy question for you, which is, how did you get into classics and ancient history? Where did this love come from?
Thanks, Lexi. It's a pleasure to be here. When people ask me that, I always say I was misinformed. I thought I was dropping out. I thought I was doing a latter-day hippie thing. It was 1970 and I was a college freshman. And I thought that by studying ancient Greek, I would get away from it all. But instead, I discovered that it was actually another way of coming back and understanding my own society and my own times. I always loved languages. And I guess the first book that really got me interested in the classics was reading Thucydides, which was, as we used to say, it blew my mind. I was amazed at how the depth of the insight and how much he spoke to the current day, which at the time in 1970 was the war in Vietnam. And from there, I went to Homer, and then I was really a goner, reading Homer, reading ancient Greek. I had some wonderful teachers. They certainly made an enormous difference as well. I think we all owe so much to our teachers. And then I had the chance to go to Greece and to study there and in Italy as well. And what can I say? There I was.
Hey, that's pretty awesome. And did you have access to like ancient history classes, like a general ancient history class or more select ones when you were in like high school?
No, nothing when I was in high school. European history, which I love, I think started with the Middle Ages and pretty quickly went to the Renaissance. And Latin wasn't offered in my high school. I took French and German.
Okay. And so when you discovered that this was like a possibility to study at the collegiate level, was there any hesitation to go into ancient history?
As an undergraduate major? Not really. I mean, I majored in history with a specialty in ancient history, and I took almost enough classes to do a classics major as well. Like guess maybe because I was stubborn and I wanted to graduate early, I didn't complete the classics major. Becoming a professional ancient historian, now that was much more of a decision. I originally wanted to be a journalist. That was my original plan. I was on the student newspaper, a very active reporter and editor, and I had a internship at a suburban daily, and I liked it, but I realized that I didn't love it enough to make a profession of it. So I decided to apply to graduate school. I was lucky enough to get in and to be able to study at the graduate level.
Wow. I mean, hey, that's awesome. I'm glad that you figured it out before you went through all the training, just to then turn around and switch professions. But I'm curious, how did you make the choice? How did you end up like choosing your graduate specialty? Because I know there's so many different like directions you could possibly go.
Well, I had no doubt that I wanted to be a historian. That was pretty easy. I actually wondered for a time whether I was going to do ancient history or modern European history. When I got to graduate school, I'd always been interested in modern Europe as well. I spent a summer studying in Germany, studying German, thought a bit about becoming a modern European historian. But really, the reasons I didn't was, first of all, the pull of the Mediterranean was pretty strong. Northern Europe's a great place, but the Mediterranean has a special appeal. And secondly, I love the teachers. I love my classes. I loved learning Greek and Latin. I was fortunate to work with a number of really great historians and classicists in graduate school. None was more influential than working with Donald Kagan. He's just a remarkable individual, perhaps the best teacher I've ever known. The chance of working with him, studying Greek history with him, well, it spoke for itself.
So cool. And I mean, I know that you're an expert really in military strategy and leadership and naval history. I know a couple of people when I came up through university who also had an interest in, like, specifically they said ancient Greek warfare. What was it about like naval history that really attracted you? And I ask this in part because when I was an undergrad, I was very taken with the Battle of Salamis in particular, but I made no attempt to do more than just take a class on that.
I like water. I'm not good at hand-eye coordination sports. So by process of eliminations, repetitive motion sports like running and swimming and rowing always really appeal to me. And like I said, I like water. So I got really interested in naval history. It involves technology, but not daunting technology, technology that even a non-technical person like me could understand or get some understanding of. So it appealed to me in various ways. Of course, it has its own kind of romance, its own kind of magic, and that was exciting as well.
And I mean, I suppose the other half is studying like ancient military leaders and such. So I'm kind of curious, do you have a favorite ancient military leader and why so?
I think Caesar is my favorite. It's not because I want to emulate Caesar. And I don't think leaders today should emulate Caesar. But gosh, he was fascinating. I mean, first of all, he was brilliant. Secondly, he really was an all-around athlete, as it goes. I mean, he was a great commander, and he was a great politician, and he was also a great writer. It's a combination that we don't often find in history. Caesar had it all. Well, he was also self-interested and egotistical and vain and deluded in the end about what he couldn't and couldn't do. And he thought nothing of subjecting his society to a civil war to advance his own agenda. Maybe all the fault doesn't lie on his shoulders. His opponent certainly deserves some of the fault as well. But he's just a fascinating figure.
Yeah, I admit I haven't really studied him as much as I probably could have, but there's a lot of history to go through. So it's a bit impossible unless you specialize in someone. So I definitely know I have a lot more to learn from him. But I approach a lot of ancient leaders, I guess, through the more modern context myself, since after I picked up my bachelor's in classics, I went into sort of modern politics, which is not too far of a jump. But it's really interesting because I guess coming in from that more modern lens, I've been able to look at what modern leaders do. And I mean, we've got, you know, modern leaders like Boris Johnson out here quoting ancient people. So, you know, how has the experience been to have this great background and then look at basically everything that's happening right now in our current climate?
Well, I think it's tremendously helpful. I teach ancient Greek history, among other things, and I love teaching about Athens and Sparta and the growth of democracy, ancient democracy, and its pluses and minuses. I think it really helped provide a background for current conversations about democracy and what democracy might mean, what it does mean, what it doesn't mean. It's also good to know. I think Americans have a tendency to look down on history and not pay attention to history. We don't pay attention even that much to our own history or to think that the world began with us. I think it's tremendously useful to look at an ancient society and an ancient democracy thousands of years ago to compare their experience to our experience. Likewise, when you talk about the rise and fall of civilizations, the Romans are a very good benchmark. They're not the only benchmark, but they are an awfully useful one. As you know, so many people ask about the United States, are we Rome? Are we going to decline like Rome? Or are we the declining republic? Are we the declining empire? I think it's really useful to get have a sense of, well, what were they really like? What were they all about? It helps us to understand where we are today.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I've noticed kind of a trend of a lot of people, they think about what obviously is closest or most impacts them in terms of conflicts. And I think we do have this tendency to look at the ancient world and separate them from us and say, okay, I'm going to look down and see what they did. But in your expertise as someone who's studied both ancient and who's looked at modern conflicts, you know, for the casual observer who just says, well, there's no parallel between the, I don't know, Peloponnesian War and Armenian genocide or conflicts in, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan. How do we do a better job of like finding the parallels, even if it's not immediately apparent?
Well, I always tell my students that it's always good to start with the fundamentals. And so when you're studying war, you want to start with the fundamental theorists to understand what it is. And by the way, I don't restrict them to the classical world. If we want to understand the fundamental theory of war, the two most important texts are Sun Tzu from ancient China and Clausewitz from 19th century Germany. But it's also important to bring into the conversation Thucydides and Machiavelli, Jomini, and 19th century Swiss writer, and some more recent theorists, Soviet theorists, as a matter of fact, American theorists. They're very much part of the conversation as well. So I think studying, you always want to ground what you're doing in the classics, whatever the classics in the field happen to be. So I think that's what I would say. I believe it's Clausewitz who says that the character of war changes, but the nature of war does not. And I think that's true. The nature of war doesn't change, but the fundamentals remain the fundamentals, and we can apply them to the study of any conflict. In fact, I think we're much better off understanding what's going on by applying the fundamentals and saying, how does this particular conflict fit into those fundamental categories?
Yeah. Oh, that's some really good insight there, because I think that we all too often definitely have a tendency not to look at conflict that way. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because we like have a tendency to just look quite inward at what is it, the human tendency to only look at what affects you directly or something like that. I know there's like a famous quote about that somewhere, but I can't remember it.
Yes, it is a part of our nature, for better or worse, that we tend to focus on ourselves and go looking inward out.
But in terms of looking, kind of referring back to the classics in the ancient world, I kind of noticed there's like a small pattern of there are still a lot of ancient conflicts that that scholarship and people just don't really focus on as much as others. So obviously we have a ton of literature and things on the ancient Mediterranean and a lot on like ancient Egypt, but like I'm sure there's a lot of really other interesting ancient civilizations and conflicts and leaders and all these things in other civilizations that just aren't as popular. You know, as I think you have the benefit as more of a well-rounded ancient historian than someone who focused just on one to say, no, this is like, no, like they all have something really valuable to contribute. What, in your opinion, like, why do you think it's not as popular to study some of these other places? Is it just because lack of evidence, or is it like just lack of interest?
I mean, you're asking a good question. I think the answer is complex. Greece and Rome have their prestige because of their classic texts and because of the influence of those texts in the West, in the Middle Ages, and the Renaissance, and since then. But of course, there are other societies that also have classic texts that haven't been studied so much in the West. And they've been studied less because they're less influential, but also because of cultural bias, because of Eurocentric bias, without question. So, for instance, I'd say I'm Jewish, and in my own culture, there's the Talmud, there's the Mishnah, there's the Hebrew Bible and all that. They've been studied to a degree, but not that much. And there's really a lot there. They could be more central to what we study. Moving a little further to the east, we haven't studied so much the text of the Hittite civilization. There's an enormous amount of evidence from Hittite civilization. In terms of Egypt, yes, we've paid a certain amount of attention to Pharaonic Egypt, but we haven't paid that much attention to Greco-Roman Egypt and to the enormous amount of texts written in Demotic Egyptian. It's a language that very few of us are prepared to study, but it's there. Classicists could be looking at these civilizations more. Of course, they're obviously in other parts of the world, in South Asia and East Asia, for example. There are other civilizations that we could be studying more. And I think that we should. Likewise, in the New World, in the Americas, there are pre-modern civilizations, pre-Columbian civilizations. And in Africa, there are pre-modern civilizations that have also been studied. Ethiopia, for example, or the civilization of what became Sudan could also be studied. In terms of looking at ancient society in the pre-modern world, I think that all of these need to be brought into the conversation. And we want to have experts working on all of these things. And the question of what we study and what we don't study has something to do with politics of any society and what groups have clout and what they want to study. At the end of the day, though, when we decide what we want to teach the young, what we want to teach in college, what we want to teach in high school, we have to pick and choose. So one thing that we want to do is we want to have a sense of Western civilization, what it is, what its roots are, and we all want to focus on teaching. But we now live in a global society, and I think it would be a mistake not also to teach young people some sense of what global society is and what classics of other civilizations are. However, I think it is a mistake to say it's all a matter of global citizenship. Global citizenship sounds nice, but there's no such thing as global citizenship. None of us is a citizen of the world. We're all citizens of countries. And one of the challenges of the Greek polis that I think for us today is it possible to be a citizen of a large institution or of a large organization? I mean, one of the ideas behind the United States is that the answer is yes, to a degree, you can be a citizen of a large organization, but you also need to belong to something more local and smaller, because you'll just get swallowed up in a large organization. That's why we have a federal system. That's why we have states, and more than 50 states. And of course, we have municipalities and local governments as well. So I think there's a real challenge ahead as to how you can have that local level and that sense of belonging to a community while also being part of a global community, the world. It's not a simple thing. And I think classics has something to contribute to that conversation, but we're not the be-all and end-all of the conversation. We're only part of the conversation. We should have a seat at the table, but we're not the whole thing.
That's so fascinating, because I know, at least I suppose since I probably went off to college, I feel like I've heard a lot of people sort of using the words global citizen or world citizen as kind of like buzzwords, keywords to imply that, like, oh yes, I'm part of something bigger and it's not just me. But it's quite fascinating to hear your take on it, because funnily enough, that's something that I started saying in the last, like, honestly, 5 years, which is, oh yes, I feel so globalized. So I feel like I'm a global citizen. I don't just want to identify with my one city or place.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good thing to do, and I feel part of the world community as well, but we don't have citizenship in the world, and we don't have any rights to determine what goes on in the rest of the world. And I think we have to also insist we should have some say in what goes on in our local communities. I mean, right now we are swept, we're in danger of being swept away by forces over which we have no control. And as part of today's world, there are going to be these forces over which we have no control, and we have to understand, we have to accept that. But I think we also have the right to say, but I do want to carve out a space where we're citizens with our fellow citizens, and we get to decide something on the local level. Thinking here about global citizenship, I worry because the only large-scale institutions that we've had before are empires, and the individual doesn't have a whole lot of say in an empire. We do have very large democracies like the United States, Brazil, and India. They're very challenging, and it's very challenging as an individual to feel that you have any say in a country like the United States, much less India. How could you have challenge on how could you have a say on the global level with 8 billion humans on Earth? Is it getting close?
I mean, I'm fascinated. So, and this kind of goes into the more contemporary stuff that I've been studying for the past year. So I'm getting really excited now. But my master's program that I just finished, it was an emphasis on Southeast European issues, like Balkan studies, basically. But a lot of it had to do with looking at the relationship of the Balkan states with the EU. And so I had to do a lot of basically work this year on EU institutions. And so I'm curious to think, you know, I know there's a lot of confusion by normal people on what exactly the EU is. They're like, is it a confederation of states? Does it operate like a big federation? So as someone who's looking at, you know, how do you have a say? And I know a lot of people in Europe complain because they're like, I don't know what these EU institutions are doing. Is the EU currently the closest thing we have to a more global citizenship? Just because, at least if you're in the EU, you can go to all the EU countries and you sort of have similar rights?
Yeah. I mean, the EU is a wonderful thing in some ways, but in other ways, it's problematic, as you know. It's got the infamous democracy deficit. I don't think anyone would say the EU is a democracy. It's a collection of democracies, but as an entity, as a global entity, it doesn't work as a democracy. And it would be difficult to make it work as a democracy. In some ways, it's a model of something good. But in other ways, the EU has a way of interfering with local ways of doing things. Sometimes we might say its interventions are for the good, and in other ways, they're not so much for the good. And I don't think the EU has worked out the balance between local government and central direction. So I think that's a challenge for the EU. And if the EU is our example of global government, I would say it's a good start, but we have a ways to go.
Yeah, it's just interesting to think about because someone made the parallel this year that while it's not completely similar, you know, the U.S. is a whole continent full of individual mini states. And so someone sort of made the example in a class of mine and just said, well, the EU is kind of like the U.S., but definitely different because instead of all of the countries of Europe being one country called Europe, they do have their individual like federal governments, and then they still do have those lower rungs of like municipal, more localized centers of power. But the parallels are really interesting to see.
Yes, but I think there's a massive difference between the EU and the US, and that is in the United States, we have transfer payments. And there's no idea in the United States, we don't have the idea that one state is going to have to pay back to the federal government, what it's borrowed. I mean, we're all in it together. Whereas in the EU, you know, poor little Greece had to pay back what it had borrowed from the EU. And, you know, the most powerful economies, like Germany and France and the Netherlands and Austria, make it clear that they're not going to subsidize the poor economy. So that's a really big difference, I would say, between the EU and the US. And an index of how far the EU has to go.
Yeah, no, it really is fascinating to look at because both systems obviously have their pros and both have their major cons. And so we can't really say one's better than the other. But I do find it interesting. I was talking with a friend the other day who I think she was talking about a trip to some other country somewhere in Europe. and how, you know, she didn't have to do anything other than she could just move there for an internship or a job if she wanted. And I think I just playfully made the comment, oh, you guys, you Europeans have it so easy. You could just move to like Slovakia and get a job and resettle in a day. How easy is that? And I think she said something like, yeah, but you Americans are so lucky. You could move all the way across your country and then there's no language barrier, no cultural difference. You can just up and move the same as I can to a completely new place, a new environment. But she was like, it's easier for you.
I think it is much easier in the United States. It really is. You know, of course, it's wonderful in that in Europe, people can move from one country to another. But the local differences and the differences in language and culture are still immense. And they're practical barriers for a lot of people. I mean, I think in both countries, it's understandable that there'd be people on the local level who don't feel as if they have as much power as they'd like as to what goes on in the system overall. But I think that in the US, we do have more power over the system as a whole than people do in the EU.
And so interesting. People, I guess, then the lesson there is we should probably give the US more credit than we do, because I know sometimes we don't and we just kind of like to complain. But there are some nice things. There are actually some nice things that we don't consider. So I want to go back a little bit. The line of questioning I had asking about leaders and other stuff like that. And it just occurred to me, maybe the reason we don't study some other not as popular ancient civilizations or leaders are because, one, the victors obviously get to write the story, the narrative. And so the losers don't really get a say in that because they're just kind of either erased or they're, yeah. But as someone who studies both the victors and those who are not, what is it about this fascination that I've noticed that humans have with like the epic, tragic hero, the one who definitely absolutely loses, but we still love them, like a Hannibal type, because that's like a really popular thing where we're like, oh yeah, but they're a lovable loser. We still, you know, look to them, try to find lessons in their losses, I suppose. So is that like a really human thing, or is there like more to actually be gained from looking at those who aren't necessarily the victors in the ancient world?
Well, it is a human thing. You're very wise. I think that we all know that failure is a part of life. None of us can be a winner all the time. And I think it's Americans are very nervous about not winning. You know, not every culture has the concept of a loser. It's a very American thing, talk about losers. But I think we sympathize with the people who fail. They're less threatening to us in a way. Then we're aware of the fact that we fail sometimes. We all fail sometimes in life. And so we want to understand, well, what do we make of failure? And how can we accept failure? How can we move on from it? How can we make sense of it? I think that's one of the appeals of you know, ancient epic and tragedy. You know, in the story of Achilles or in the story of Oedipus or the story of Antigone. These are people who failed big. and yet they're heroes on a certain level. And we learn from them and we admire from them. And it's the wisdom that they gain, the courage that they show in the face of suffering. They're tremendously appealing.
Interesting. You know, I never thought about the concept of winning and losing as a super American thing until just now.
It's a very American thing. I mean, an Italian friend of mine who spends a lot of time in the U.S. had to explain to people in Italy what the concept of a perdente is, because it's not something that they really talk about.
Wow. So, I mean, for some of these other cultures, I mean, in the ancient world, I mean, there were clear winners and losers, as we know, but also, like, I guess it's still, even back then, wasn't quite as black and white as it is today.
No, I mean, no, I don't think it was. I don't think it was. I don't think they would think of someone as a loser. I don't know how you'd say that in ancient Greek or Latin. Maybe you can. I don't know. But, yeah.
Well, doesn't it show up in like ancient sport where you don't get like, you know, ancient Olympics or something where you get first place and then you don't, isn't it like not everyone was like a loser per se, but it was just the winner and then you have like the second winner or the...
No, they didn't. They only had first prizes. There were no second and third prizes. But in the ancient Olympics, you know, you win or that's it. But come to think of it, there is some thought about losers in ancient culture. Ajax is a tragedy about somebody who can't accept his defeat and who destroys himself because of the burden of defeat. But I think that's a little different from our concept of someone being a loser.
That's true. I mean, but I feel like some things have carried over. Okay, so sticking with the theme of like the ancient Olympics, okay, even if you don't, if you only have the winner and that's it, I think even today in like the modern Olympics, like we still respect and on some level revere athletes who may not win the gold, but we still see them as like, oh, well, you're still someone worthy of being looked up to. Like the reputation of being an Olympian is enough to inspire like awe, right? And I would say, I mean, I only took one class in like the ancient Olympics, and that was like freshman year, so it was a long time ago. But I feel like there was something about, yeah, like if you were an ancient Olympian in that time, even if you didn't win, like you were still highly respected because you made it.
I don't know. I mean, I can't think offhand of any ancient speech or text where somebody says, well, I competed in the Olympics. I didn't win, but I competed. The thing that comes to mind is a speech of Alcibiades in Thucydides, where he brags about his Olympic victory, and then he brags about the time he forced all of Greece to fight in a coalition and against Athens and its enemies, and they lost. But it still is a great thing. I think that's meant to be a kind of sophistic scam and to show what fast talkers can do. I think that maybe ancient society is more harsh in the dichotomy between winning and losing. It wanted to glorify the winners. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but
you know, I don't either, because it's been so long since I've taken this class that I'm honestly sitting here trying to rack my brain for anything that will sort of, you know, clank around in there.
There's probably some text where somebody talks, you know, prides himself, because it's only males, I'm afraid, prides himself on competing in the Olympics and not winning, but I can't think of any offhand.
It's okay, I can't either. if we think of something, we can do a follow-up and say, hey, we remembered.
By the way, there is one example, a famous example of a woman who wins in the Olympics, and that is Kiniska of Sparta. She is a member of the royal family, and she sponsors chariot races that win and puts up a monument commemorating this. She's not a competitor, but the person who wins the chariot race is basically the sponsor, the owner of the chariot. That's the person who gets the prize, not the charioteer. And in this case, Kiniska, the Spartan woman, had she was the owner. She's the one who paid for and sponsored this. So she wins the Olympic prize.
Wow. Okay. That's very different from nowadays. But that's really, I mean, hey, at least we can say a woman sort of won something.
Yeah. But of course, in the Super Bowl, it's the owner of the team who gets the prize. You think about it. You know, the team owner gets to, you know, hold up the cup at the ceremony at the end of the Super Bowl.
True. Although, but isn't it still passed around? And
sure. Yes. It's more democratic than in the Olympics.
Okay. But I was like, well, I guess you're right, though. Like, the owner would keep the trophy. He would keep it long run. And you could put it in your building or something. But I suppose you're right. The players don't get to keep it.
No. Only for the year, I think. Then it goes to the next one, I think. But maybe wrong. I may be wrong. I don't know
enough about football or any of this. I was like, I know for things like hockey, there's one Stanley Cup, and I know that they don't keep that and they get their rings. But
I think it's called the Lombardi Trophy, and I don't know if it moves from place to place. I kind of think it does, but I'm not sure. But as you say, the Stanley Cup, we've got that.
Yeah, so I was like, well, there's some that do, some that don't, because I know baseball is my favorite sport, and I do know that individual teams get to keep their team trophy, and they just make a new one every year. That's why I'm not an expert in modern sport, or else I would know those answers. I believe a billion years ago, someone gifted me your book on the Battle of Salamis, because I know that came out when I was either in high school or something, and it was a gift. Now, I can't ask you specific questions because it's been a very long time since I read it. But for other folks who love that battle as much as I do, would you tell us a little bit about it and like refresh my memory at least? So for folks who are interested in Salamis, you know, give us something to read.
So the Battle of Salamis is the turning point in the war between the Greeks and the Persians when the Persians, led by their king Xerxes, invaded the Greek mainland. And the Greeks had been losing up until Salamis. And this was a naval battle right off the coast of Athens within sight of the Acropolis. You'd have to have very good eyes to see it in the Acropolis. You can see the site in general between the mainland and the island of Salamis. So in a space that's a couple of miles off the coast of the mainland, a mile and a half at its narrowest. And the Greek fleet defeated the Persian fleet. It really handed its head to the Persian fleet as a result of, above all, of the leadership of Themistocles, the Athenian leader who was extremely cunning and who managed to double-cross both sides in order to win this victory. The war continued after that, but the Persian navy and the Persian king were forced to go home, and Persia had occupied central Greece with a much smaller force, a land army. It was finally defeated by Spartan-led Greek army the next spring. But Salamis was the turning point. It really saved Greece from the Persians.
So I need to go back and reread the book, but if you are interested in any of the like Greco-Persian wars, this would be your book. And I know you have a new book coming out, and would you please tell us about that if we want to go read that?
Sure. So it actually came out in March. It's my most recent book. It's called The War That Made the Roman Empire, Antony, Cleopatra, and Octavian at Actium. And it's about another great naval battle off the coast of Greece. This one is the battle for control of the Roman Empire almost 500 years later. So Salamis is 480 BC and Actium is 31 BC. It's between, on the one hand, the forces of Mark Antony and his ally and mistress Cleopatra. And on the other hand, the forces of Octavian with a big assist from his right-hand man and great general, Marcus Agrippa. And what was at stake was who would control the Roman Empire. So it's a very dramatic battle and very interesting because it's not just a battle, but it's also a campaign. And in some ways, the key events took place 6 months earlier in a very dramatic and daring raid on the coast of Greece that was launched by Agrippa. So another exciting story and one with larger than life characters. And thanks to Shakespeare, it's got unforgettable characters, above all Cleopatra, one of the most extraordinary woman rulers in all history.
So would it be fair to say it's basically just a novelization of the battle?
No, it's a history book.
Okay, it's a history book. Okay.
Not a novelization. As a historian, I pride myself on writing books that are readable and that focus on characters. And this is an example of this, but I did a lot of research on this book in many different languages. So it is firmly based in the historical reality and in the literary evidence, the archaeological evidence, and the recent archaeological evidence has told us a lot that we didn't know. And the numismatic evidence, coins are a very important part of this story as well.
Well, that definitely sounds like a book for me because I'm a little amateur numismatist. I absolutely love looking at coins.
I think like it, the coin evidence for this and for Cleopatra is quite fascinating.
Oh, I can't wait to go buy this book. I need to read. This is going to be the next thing on my reading list. So now that the new book is on Actium, I mean, this is a quite famous battle, and I'm curious. There have been a couple that I know of, and then probably more that I'm not aware of, but there's a couple very notable recreations of this famous battle in TV, film, media. And I was wondering if you had a favorite adaptation and whether you think any of these did it justice or whether it was completely inaccurate.
Well, the short answer is no, they don't do it justice. I mean, my favorite adaptation is Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. I mean, that's magnificent. It doesn't do justice to the historical reality, but Shakespeare did a really good job considering when he was writing. He did an extremely good job of being close to the history. And the battle only takes place off stage in Shakespeare. I don't remember how they depict the battle in the famous and infamous Hollywood movie Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And I don't know what other recreations of Actium there are. I'm sure I'm forgetting about some important ones. But no, I don't think that Hollywood has done justice to it yet.
I mean, it's hard, if not almost impossible. I feel like, as someone who studied the ancient world, to see something that I'm like, yes, this is so good, it captures it. Oh, okay. I'm only aware of like two really high profile adaptations of it. One was the Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor, which it was fine because I remember they had them sailing to Actium, but basically it was like just this one scene of Antony's ship pursuing what he thought was Octavian's ship. So they basically like set the ship on fire, and then you just see like random dudes fighting, and then you see Cleopatra's barge like running away, and then it cuts to a shot of Antony saying, "Is she leaving me?" And then like jumps off into a little boat and runs away. So it was pretty short, because it cuts to a lot of like the strategizing on land of people looking over the military table and going, ah, what if we do this? So you don't see a lot of the action, but I think the only other one that I'm remembering is they portrayed a tiny bit of it in the HBO Rome series. It was like one at the end of like one of the last episodes in the series, in the second series. So I think most of it you don't see on screen. You might see a little bit, but you hear of it. I don't remember them doing a very notable job on it, so it probably wasn't even that good or extensive. And then they might have included it in like a video game or two. I'm sure the newest, well, the not new, but the, yeah, I'm pretty sure like the Assassin's Creed set in Egypt featured that, but I don't think it was very good either. Is that just logistics wise, like filming it and either not using CGI or
you have to use CGI? You have to use CGI, but also all of us have some sense of what life is like on land, but most of us don't really know what life is like at sea. We don't really understand the winds, the waves. Tide's not a big factor in the Mediterranean. It is, of course, in the ocean. So it's kind of hard to, show. It really is.
I mean, do we do land battles any better though? I'm trying to think of like really good land battles that capture, like the 2004, I want to say, Alexander movie. I know they tried to show several of his epic campaigns, and either for Hollywood reasons, I know they cut some down or cut some back, or people didn't get a full sense of like his military genius because they were like, oh, okay, just random people fighting.
I forget if they make what their biggest battle is, whether it's Issus or Gaugamela. But I think it did a pretty good job. There were things about it that I liked. And I liked the way they depicted Alexander at the Battle of the Granicus. So it wasn't bad. It really wasn't bad.
I mean, the best thing I heard about that was that they got his hair right.
Oh, they got his hair right, yeah. I mean, the movie as a whole has its issues, but it had some moments. You know, another film that they didn't get the battle so right, but it has some good features, is The Kingdom of Heaven, which has the Battle of Hattin in 1187. You know, they filmed it in Morocco, I think, so it doesn't really look like the Galilee where the battle took place. But it's got some moments. I think it's a pretty useful movie in some ways.
I do remember liking that one. There was, although I remember there being some controversy over like the director's cut versus the theatrical, because they left
the director's cut is much better than the theatrical version of Kingdom of Heaven.
So one of the few last things I did want to ask you about was, I've seen that you've done some consulting work for like television series, for historical things. And I was just curious, for young historians or classicists who are interested in that sort of thing, you know, what was your experience like being able to be one of the few people who got to do history and then also dabble a bit in consulting for TV?
Oh, I think there are many of us, but I mean, I was lucky. I was fortunate to be asked. And I think I learned a lot about communications and how you tell stories to people. Sometimes I was horrified at the things that had to be left out or things that had to be simplified. But by the same token, I learned that there's something to be said for not overwhelming people with facts. And I think that we academics have a tendency to frankly to want to show off how much we know. And maybe we feel anxious that if we don't show off how much we know, nobody will respect us. But I think that, you know, there's a huge audience of intelligent lay people out there who don't want to be talked down to, but who don't want to have to absorb 1,000 names and dates. They just want the few most important ones. And I think the experience of working with these TV series shows you that. That's a good thing I think I took away from the experience. I think I don't want to dwell on the bad things, but the good things are really good.
That's really great to hear. And I mean, I know a couple people who they would love, that's like their dream job, is to consult on things. But as someone who's done it, you know, do you think this is going to be a viable kind of permanent job thing in the future? Or is this like a side gig that most young people who want to, you know, be classists, be historians, they're going to have to just be like, okay, it's a side gig because I can't actually do a full-time consulting thing.
It's a side gig. That being said, there are people who study history who then go work in the entertainment industry. And some who work in making documentaries and making series such as the ones you see on TV. Now, that's not a side gig. That can be a full-time job. But I think consulting is just a side gig.
And just as someone who's dabbled and done so much, if there were any great military campaign or figure who we don't think has been covered enough, is there anything you'd like to see, you know, made into a series or something that would be really, really cool for, I mean, everyone, but also certainly for historians to see brought to life? Because, I mean, we love seeing the Actiums and Peloponnesian Wars and stuff, but and Trojan War for sure, but it's all overdone. And we have so many things, and there's so many things that we haven't done.
Well, of course, I think should be my own book, and we should do Actium. That needs to be done. And as you said, it hasn't been done well, so I'd have to make a pitch for myself.
That's totally fair. I would like to see it done because it is a great battle, and it does. It is very worthy of having a faithful adaptation made. So I'm going to hope that someone will pick it up and do something amazing with it then. So kind of there's like three questions I kind of usually ask to end the interview portion of the podcast. And the first is, when you were a student, and this could be either in undergrad or grad school, did you attend office hours?
I did, yes. Both undergraduate and graduate.
Great. And from these experiences, do you have a favorite memory or conversation or any experience from one of these times?
That's a really good question. I fondly remember sitting in Professor Kagan's office in graduate school, and he had this wonderful poster on the wall of the charioteer at Delphi, and he had a window into a courtyard, and the light would come in, as I remember and imagine it, and then he would be there speaking. He was so informal and so relaxed and so magisterial in a kind of informal, again, to use that word, informal, friendly kind of way. Those were great conversations. I remember them very, very fondly.
Oh, that's great to hear. And so from the other side now, as an educator yourself, if you had to give students like an elevator pitch for why office hours are important to go to, what would you say?
That is a great question as well. And my elevator pitch would be, never underestimate the importance of personal contact. And this would be my lesson for your generation in general. I think that people who grew up in the digital world tend to think, You don't really have to do personal contact. You can do it by email or by Zoom or by text or whatever the latest and greatest thing is. Wrong. Nothing is more important than personal contact. And, you know, let's get real. You want that person who's going to put a grade, give you a grade, to know who you are and to have pleasant thoughts about you. And so office hours are that. And maybe to be a little bit less cynical, you can get faculty members to say things and tell you things and reveal things in office hours that they're not going to do in a more formal setting, because we're all human beings. So there's that as well. You might learn something.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't have said it better, because I definitely would never leave my professor's office hours. They probably were, I joke that they lovingly couldn't wait to kick me out of their office because they wanted to go home. So... and so finally, at the end of each podcast, I ask if every guest will read Percy Shelley's beautiful poem, Ozymandias. And after you've read it, if you could just give us your thoughts on, like, you know, do you like this poem? If it, you know, if it seems like it's a really powerful poem, you know, what is it that stands out about it to you?
I will do that.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Ozymandias. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear: My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away."
You know, I do, but also, no, it was truly amazing, because I do love it when it's read by, like, a very epic-sounding, deep voice. So it sounds, you know, appropriate.
Oh, thank you. You must say that to all your guests, but thank you.
You know, having read this poem, though, like, what do you think about it? Like, does it speak to you?
Oh, certainly. This poem is always has spoken to me. You know, the romance of ruins and the vanity of the vanity of human civilization, you know, nothing less. And the power of kings and tyrants is the most vain thing of all. I mean, what's most important from antiquity is it's literature, it's art, it's architecture, not the claims to power that individual rulers had. And Shelley captures it so beautifully. It's just a beautiful poem. And that's the thing about the Romantic poets. It was just this wonderful moment in civilization where it's just the right combination of classical and emotional, passionate. Another of my favorite poems is on first reading Chapman's Homer, silent upon a peak in Darien, the way that ends. It just gives me the chills the way that poem ends. And this one as well, A Traveler from an Antique Land. I think there's a very good book by Amitav Ghosh called A Traveler from an Antique Land, or maybe just From an Antique Land. These poems are just, they've just got such wonderful language to them.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's my favorite poem ever for basically those same reasons. But I mean, I take it one step further and definitely I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a brilliantly crafted 14-line political treatise and Memento Mori all crammed in those 14 lines by Shelley.
Beautifully said. Yes. Yes.
I mean, it's fantastic. And it also gave me the avenue to be able to figure out new ways of considering what Shelley meant when he was writing. And so one of the questions I love asking guests on my show is, if we think about our contemporary society right now, like, do we have a modern day Ozymandias, like something that we think is so great and amazing and powerful, but like, realistically, are future humans going to look back and say, oh yeah, totally, it's monumental, it's here? Or will we look back and say, like, this is the stupidest thing we've ever thought of?
I'm going to say social media. Look on my work, see mighty in despair.
I really think you're right about that one, especially since, honestly, people these days don't have the attention span to get through more than a 1 minute TikTok, right?
You got it. That's for sure.
which is a bit funny, considering I will sit down and read like a tome on ancient Greece, and yet I don't even have the patience to sit through a 1 minute TikTok. Someone will send me one, and I'll be like, I couldn't be bothered. It's too hard. It's too long.
Well, bravissima, Lexi. That's all I can say, if that's what you do. But all of our, we need to work on those patience muscles for each of us. You know, read 19th century novels and things. So it gets us back where we need to go.
Yeah, because people don't read anymore. They just scroll on their Instagram reels. And I'm like, no, but books.
Students don't read. Let me tell you, they don't read.
Exactly. Or, you know, we're big babies and we like people to read to us, because I will admit that I do enjoy audiobooks, because it's like someone reads to me and I don't have to actually sit down with the book. But that's just if I'm busy doing something and then I'm lazy, and then I'll be like, okay, I'll pop in an audiobook. And so the last question I really want to ask you is, where can people find you and your, like, your books, and you know, if they just want to, you know, see more of your work?
People can find me at my website, barrystrauss.com. Nothing could be easier. BarrystrauS.com. And there you can find all my books. You can buy them to your heart's content. And you can find latest updates on me. When this podcast is ready, I will put it on my website. But also, I've got my own podcast, Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, and that's one of the places you can access it. As well, I've also got a blog that I update every 2 weeks. And you can subscribe, you can sign up and get email blasts every time a new blog is out. It's going to be tomorrow, as a matter of fact, given the day that we're speaking. But yeah, barrystrauss.com is where I live.
Oh, amazing. Great. Well, I will link all of the wonderful things for people to find in the show notes. And thank you so much again for joining me. I was so excited to have this conversation, and hopefully we can have you on in the future.
Sure. Thanks for asking such great questions. And please let me know when this is posted. Not everybody does, but I'd love that if you do, so that I can put it on my sites as well.
For sure, for sure.
Trireme Transit is now departing Ancient Office Hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.